Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to another episode of Everyone is Hot, the podcast that talks about your favorite stealth sex symbols and the film that turned you onto them. I'm Michael Stevens.
And I'm Shelley Brooks, and baby Michael, we've got a really good guest today.
Oh my God, I am so excited. We have film writer Esme Holden, everyone.
Hooray! Yay! Oh. The children are so excited.
The children. I'm so happy to meet the children.
And the children are happy to see you. The children have bowed and now they've exited the room like the Von Trapps.
Goodbye. 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 Bye-bye, Hugh. Wonderful.
Esme, welcome. Oh my God. So you are joining us all the way from Manchester, yeah?
From rainy Manchester. Yep. On Pride, of all things.
Oh, is it Pride there?
It's Manchester Pride today. Wow. Yeah. You might be able to hear it. So apologies.
God, I hope so. Oh, that would be a great soundtrack. Well, we are sorry to like keep you indoors during Pride. we're so happy to have you. We were just talking before we got on. About the cinematic lineage of Manchester. We talked about the fact that we previously covered the movie Naked, which talks about Manchester a lot, but the only scene there is a scene of sexual assault. And then you
in
mentioned...
In a horrible alley.
Yeah, in a dank alley.
I actually did try and find out where that alley is, but I couldn't find any records because I was going through all the locations, obviously, because like even the stuff in London's familiar to me.
Yeah. Wait, are you telling me that there's not like a walking tour of Manchester that's like movie locations? Here's where Johnny rapes a woman. But you said also 24-hour party people, the Michael Winterbottom movie was shot there.
That's yes? Like the kind of only full Manchester movie, I feel like.
Yeah.
I guess Peterloo as well, another Michael movie.
Which I love Peterloo. Michael and I have been talking about doing a Mike Lee episode, but I feel like I can't push for us to talk about Peterloo because I might be the only person who likes it.
I saw it twice in the cinema.
Oh, you are so... making my heart like beat faster. Like I fucking loved Peterloo so much, and I feel like everyone I knew was like, crap, slow, we hate it.
Boring.
And I was
like, it's too much about talking.
Yeah, too much about the infighting of like leftist politics and organizing.
It's too much about like the minor variations in the same speech, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the way that people talk around each other. But I swear to God, that like the mirroring of that opening image of like the boy in the field and then the mirror at the end of him, you know, in the aftermath of the Peterloo massacre. I think about it maybe once a week. Oh, good stuff. Anyway,
the other good Manchester thing, not film related, is that you know the original show where Bob Dylan played electric guitar?
Mm-hmm.
So that's supposed to be in London, but it's actually mislabeled and was in Manchester.
Really?
So it's called like the, I can't remember the place it is, but it's called the, like, in quotes, whatever the venue is in London.
Yeah.
But the actual one where he gets shouted at and booed is in Manchester. So there you go.
Oh my God.
What a lovely little
within
place.
Within the boundaries of where the Peterloo Massacre was. So...
I will say that this is a great like triptych of events. So the sexual assault and naked, the Peterloo Massacre, and then what you know, people at the time considered the massacre of folk music, Dylan going electric. That's amazing.
Well, I'm not quite as familiar with Mike Lee's work, but I am very interested in doing a little intro to Mike Lee for myself, since the first show that the first movie that we watched for this show was actually Naked. It was the first movie that me and Shelley were like, oh, let's like test out like how our show will go. Let's talk about David Thewlis
and like comedy
Naked.
Show.
comedy show. And I was like, oh, cool. I'm ready for this. Like, and I watched it and I was like, Shelly, what the fuck? I'm so upset. And now I'm going to go, ha ha ha. But I'm gonna give it another chance. And I want to know, what other Mike Lee movies should I start out with as like an intro?
Life is Sweet.
Life
That's
is Sweet.
The one I said immediately, yes. Okay. Is that your favorite?
It probably.
Mine too.
Probably.
Yeah.
Okay. Partly for the there's a particularly evil moment where there's the most like emotional speech you've ever heard, like so moving.
Oh my God.
And then the character drops in like a really regressive kind of upsetting comment. It's just pure evil, you know, like
it's so good. It gets families and like family dynamics like so well. And also, you know, Timothy Spall with a pineapple, come on.
Yeah, I mean,
okay. So I'm watching
Elvis voice like yes.
I'm watching Life is Sweet and I'm watching Peterloo. Is that what I'm watching? For my intro?
I would say intro, not Peterloo, right? Not would Peterloo.
Secrets and Lies is like the epic kind of big scale. I mean, epic in the way a Mike Lee movie is, but it's like, it feels big. It's sprawling.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's kind of got everything in there.
Yeah, it's emotionally epic. And what's the Gilbert and Sullivan topsy-turvy? You would love that.
I haven't actually seen that one. That's one of the only ones I've not seen.
Well, it is fantastic. And also, Michael is a little theater nerd, loves musicals. So,
right.
Okay.
Topsy-turvy.
Okay.
People like.
Okay. I'm still going to watch Peterloo because I want to know why you don't want me to watch it.
why am I not allowed to watch it? it's a big one for a first watch. And I luckily saw it in a theater, which I think is good because it's very long and it's very... very small for a lot of it.
Yeah.
Very specific. It's very much about detail, you know.
Yeah, and I think it'd be I think it'd be a bit hard watching at home. Cause like
I'm a big boy.
I'd want to look at my phone. I love Peterloo, but I would want to look at my phone if I watched it at home.
Okay.
Like it's one of those movies where like I think part of the appeal of it is that you have to sit with boredom a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love sitting with boredom. Are you kidding me?
Well, then perfect. You'll love Peterloo. We are talking about a movie that is going to be pretty much the exact opposite of Peterloo.
It's the exact opposite. There's so much shit happening. This whole fucking movie.
So, Esme, who is your stealth sex symbol and what movie are we going to be talking about today?
So I couldn't resist a chance as one of the few like cursed with this interest to talk about Jerry Lewis in The Ladies' Man, his second directorial effort.
I am so excited to talk about this because, as you said, kind of cursed. I am not generally a Jerry Lewis fan. I was only familiar with this film because I had watched clips from it because I knew it had influenced Tu Va Bien, the Godard film. And so I knew it was like formally important, but I also like if you had wanted to go like really cursed, I can't believe you didn't choose like The Day the Clown Cried. We could have like gone to the archives, try to find it.
I went on a quest.
Back when it comes out and I'll do an episode.
Yeah,
on that.
I think they did find a print of it, which I think
it does exist. There's just like rights reasons it can't come out until I think this or next year, but it will be available.
Insane.
Thankfully, thank God.
Insane. For the listener, if you're not aware, Jerry Lewis did make a Holocaust movie called The Day the Clown Cried, which honestly, like, everything that I've read about it, it doesn't sound that different from a movie that I hate very much. What is it called? The Roberto Benigni movie.
Life is Beautiful. Or
yeah,
something?
I hate that fucking movie. And like, it sounds like it's not that different from The Day the Clown Cried, to be honest.
But I mean, from seeing The Ladies Man, you can tell that Jerry doesn't quite know how to give a straight emotional approach to something. So it would be much more bizarre and
True. Oh my God. So yeah, this was a fascinating choice. And I'm glad that you chose it, because I actually ended up really enjoying the movie and finding it very fascinating and finding him very hot, which is something I never thought that I would ever say.
Oh
my God. I was so confused by how I was made to feel watching this, because I only know Jerry Lewis from, like, my dad was like, hey, you ever seen the original Nutty Professor? And I was like, no. Yes. And so he was like, all right, we'll watch that. And I was like, I don't like this guy, Dad. I don't like this guy one bit. So that's my relationship with Jerry Lewis. Imagine my surprise and chagrin when there's like shots of this man's ass. And I was like, wow, he's like, he's really got like a body. He's got like a nice.
And he knows it. You know?
He knows he has a nice body, this piece of shit. He knows he's hot. He's got a fucking Kevin Hart vibe about him where it's just like, you can't be one of us. You can't be, you're not a regular degular. You're too fucking. God.
We are absolutely going to get into Jerry Lewis's ego, his the faux nerd shit that he did in his movies, and how he was a hot guy, but also the extenuating circumstances of like anti-Semitism in Hollywood at the time. We're gonna get into all of it. But if
God,
anyone
he cheated
has
on
not...
his wife with Marilyn Monroe, like come on,
yeah, like,
come on. He's very open about his infidelity.
But if someone has not seen the 1961 film The Ladies Man, both directed by and starring Jerry Lewis, not The Ladies Man starring Eddie Constantine, which I accidentally rented before I rented this one, which ties in because Tu Vas Bien, Godard, Alphaville, wait. Eddie Constantine, The Ladies Man, connections all over. I'm like putting strings and pictures on a corkboard right now.
Oh my God. There's like three The Ladies Mans. There's so many The Ladies Mans is what that means.
Yeah, there are many movies called The Ladies Man, but we're focusing on the 1961 Ladies Man directed by Jerry Lewis, starring Jerry Lewis. Michael, can you tell the listeners, what is this movie about?
All right, for the listener, there's like 9 different synopses here, so I'm just going to go with my best guess at what I watched. After his girlfriend leaves him for someone else, Herbert Hebert wants to escape from women. He sets out to find a job and finds one as a housekeeper for a house full of women. That was the right one, right?
That was. I Frankensteined that a little bit, because I took... So, Esme, we tend to take these synopses from IMDb. A running thing that we talk about is how often unusual the synopses are on IMDb. But listen, when I was putting together the script, I had to do a little doctoring. So because I felt like we definitely had to fit in the name Herbert Hebert.
Yes, of
course. Or as he would say, Hebert.
Oh, God. I'll save it for later. Yeah, that.
It's also a hard movie to plot synopsize because there's not a lot of like things that connect to the things that happen before or after. Really?
Yeah, it's sketches.
Yeah.
It's
basically Jerry Lewis has a girl dump him at his college graduation, so he has an excuse to be in a house and get into hijinks with a bunch of hot ladies. That's it.
And it's quite like obscure to understand what this house is actually supposed to be. I feel like you don't really find out until like, so I think because the lady who runs the house has like an interview on TV later on.
Yes.
And she says something about like training people to be, she's like an opera singer or something. So she's like training people to be artistic. But this comes like well over an hour in. And you just have no sense that it's mostly women getting dressed up perfectly to like walk up and downstairs, it seems like.
Yeah, that comes very late in the film. I interpreted it very differently when I was watching it sounded to me like she was basically saying like, it's a home for girls who are like me, sluts. These girls were too slutty and horny to live in the outside world, which maybe I need to rewatch. But that seemed to be the subtext to me. But
I thought I just thought it was a school for ladies.
Well, this movie is so rich that it's, you know, up for interpretation like this. But before we get into the nitty gritty of this rich text that is Jerry Lewis's The Ladies' Man, we like to get a little warmed up with a game we call the Sexy Trivia Game. Michael, what is the Sexy Trivia Game?
Well, it's just a little warm-up to get the listener ready to talk about some movies. I'll kick us off. During this production, Jerry Lewis attached a small video camera to the side of his 35mm camera, in effect pioneering the video assist system that is standard on just about every feature film today. Wow. I love a man with a piece of history dangling around.
He was into technical experimentation, which I think is one of the beauties of this movie. Esme, can you give us number B?
Of course I can. When Jerry Lewis did his scene with Baby, the African lion, aka Zamba, he had a gun in his inside pocket for protection.
What a guy.
Just to remind actually... Esme is coming from the UK, so she might not be used to the fact that guns are everywhere here in the UK.
Guns are everywhere here. Oh, my God.
We got a whole lot of them, unfortunately. But I'm going to, on that note, finish us off with number C. This movie was mostly filmed on one of the largest interior sets ever built. The full-scale replica of a multi-story sorority house, constructed to break way to accommodate camera movement, occupied an entire soundstage on the Paramount backlot. And that's the Sexy Trivia Game.
Ooh.
A technically fascinating film.
I feel like I got the least sexy bit of trivia, I'll be honest.
You didn't like the gun bit?
Protection, I got it, right, yeah.
Yeah. Did y'all know that Mel Brooks was initially, he wrote some scenes for the movie? He was like writing the movie with Jerry Lewis, but I guess they butted heads. And
really?
Yeah, but Mel Brooks was like, I'm pissed. That. Yeah. He's like, I'm pissed.
Well, I mean,
I'm done.
The main reason
take my name off.
Jerry would direct stuff was ostensibly because he didn't want anyone else to tell her what to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Basically.
Yeah. Which, I mean, that is interesting to me because I can see that because, man, from what I know of Jerry Lewis, from his films that I've seen, from, you know, the lore that I've read about him, he does seem to be an incredible egomaniac. But that said, I mean, there is that incredible sequence with, I have to check his name, but the guy who plays the, you know, sort of maybe a gangster paramour of one of the girls who comes in, who I when I was reading earlier, I think was a sort of like a vaudeville performer. And he clearly had respect for other comedians because my favorite moment in the movie is when they're doing the bit where Jerry Lewis is putting his hat back on and he keeps doing it the wrong way. He's like, you gotta open my eye, I can't see. And then he's like pulling a thread and he's like, you're pulling my eyebrow. And you see Jerry Lewis break because it's shot from behind his back and you're looking at the other actor, but you see Jerry Lewis's shoulders start to shake and you hear a little bit of like on the soundtrack, and that is the most charming. I mean, there is a lot that I think is wonderful about this movie, but that was like the most charming moment to me, is that like he clearly had so much respect for this other comic performer that like he kept in him breaking, you know.
I think Kathleen Threeman, Katie, like the kind of cook, those two have really good, you can see a lot of scenes that are clearly just like them in the same room and they're just like, yeah, to see where this goes.
Yeah.
So like pushing each other back and forth. So they have a real like, I feel like she's the equivalent to him as, I'm trying to remember her name, Margaret Dumont is in the Marx Brothers movie.
Yes.
You know, she kind of looks similar even. They mm-hmm. kind of play a similar straight kind of role.
Yeah. Though it's funny because I feel like Dumont, like, I mean, she really plays the straight character. Like everything she does is just being like, hey, Mr. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Why are you here? Like, she's just setting up punchlines for Groucho. And I think that Kathleen Freeman, like, she gets to have her own gags and, like, she gets to have her own jokes in a way that, like, so Michael and I texted about this a little bit before, but I mean, one thing that, like, kind of soured me on Jerry Lewis for many years is the fact that, you know, in his old age, he was like, women aren't funny. Women can't tell a joke. And, like, but he clearly respected her as a comic actor because he, you know, he keeps in a lot of her stuff and, like, they have this amazing comedic rapport together. Like, it's so, you know, obviously it's probably one of those things where it's like, women aren't funny, except that Kathleen. She's, that broad knew how to do it. But like,
in his Wikipedia, he's made notable exceptions for, like, Lucille Ball, Whoopi Goldberg. There are a couple of funny women.
Okay.
But I will say, across if the those board. Are your exceptions, like, if you could be like, that Whoopi, she's good. It's like, all right, well, you know, he's got some taste. Like, he's a bigot, but, like, he's, like, not so bigoted that he can't recognize genius, you know?
Yeah, he's not a,
yeah, but I'm so interested. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, like, I came to this movie originally. I didn't grow up on, like, Martin and Lewis or anything. Like, my parents weren't really, like, movie people. So I first learned about this movie through Godard's Tout va bien, which, you know, it inspired the, like, open set that they have in Tout va bien. And, you know, a lot of it's a cliche that, like, French people love Jerry Lewis. And I don't know how true that actually is or if it's just kind of one of those things where, like, they love Chaplin and they love Lewis. But I could see where a lot of the, like, new wave directors would love Lewis because, I mean, this is, like, a very a formally interesting sort of, like, metatextual film. Like, it's beautifully shot. I mean, the color photography is gorgeous, but even just, like, the camera movements, like, moving between the levels of the house, the brilliance of having that set. I mean, there's a shot early on where, like, it pans through this open set and then it comes to a close up on, like, a woman, like, adjusting her stockings on the stairs that like was really breathtaking to me. And then having, like, for the TV sequence, the equipment set up just outside of the set in a way that, like, mimics what would be going on with the camera equipment that would be shooting the movie itself, which you can, as the viewer, imagine, like, another layer behind that. Like, I mean, so is that something that, like, makes this movie interesting to you? Because, I mean, you are a knowledgeable film person. So is it that it hits you, like, on a guttural comedic level, or is it more interesting sort of, like, metatextually for you?
Well, because I'm British, right? Like, Jerry Lewis isn't really, like, a cultural thing here. A lot of that comedy doesn't really, like, I didn't know who the Three Stooges were until I was, like, 18. You know, it's not really, like, a thing. It's not really, like, a reference point. So I definitely came through the, like, you know, Cahiers du Cinéma and Godard in specific, you know, who was really, he says some, like, ridiculous, you know, Jerry Lewis was more a painter than a filmmaker, something to that effect, you know, whatever that means. But I think what I like about Jerry Lewis is that he has this incredible mix of, like, perfectionism and sloppiness. He's, like, as an artist, a total open wound. Like, he's not very rigorous. Like, the emotional scenes in this, they are so they're so out of nowhere. They're so intense. Yeah. They're so sappy. And I think you just get a portrait of this guy who's both, you know, a brilliant technician in a lot of ways, both of his, like, you know, like you were talking about with the playback, you know, one of the first people to really do that, so he could watch his own performance and make sure it was right.
Right.
But also, like, the fact that some of the ideas don't even really make that much sense. Like the house, like he doesn't bother to establish what it is. It's just a house with lots of women and whatever.
Yep, it's a dollhouse.
Which is exciting in some ways because like it feels like a kind of dream in like in a way that feels like a Fellini movie in some ways. Yeah. But yeah.
Well, I mean that image that the Barbie movie borrowed, right, of the empty mirror, of them looking in the mirror and mm-hmm. just seeing us is such a great image. You know?
It's fantastic.
And there's a genuine like every character in this, and we'll come back to this a bit later when we're doing recommendations and pairings. Every character feels ready to like burst out emotionally. It takes one thing and everyone's crying and screaming, you know, like you were talking about the scene with the hat and the way that plays isn't this gangster getting more and more angry at Jerry. It's him like being broken down.
I think it's such an interesting combination. I think why this film is like kind of brilliant is because there is that sort of like formal exactness that he clearly learned by, you know, being someone who came up like in Hollywood at that time. Like he knows how the camera works. He knows, you know, mise-en-scène, but he also, I mean, there's like a kind of like Borscht Belt comedy to it. And I think, you know, I mentioned before that, like, you know, he's an obviously good looking guy who's like playing like the schlemiel in part because, you know, Hollywood was pretty anti-Semitic at the time, but you as a comedian you could work in that like Yiddishisms, like he does stuff like, you know, for what should I do that or whatever, like, you know, that kind of like Yinglish like grammar that, you know, is identifiably like, you know, Jewish and like Yiddish inflected, that you could do that as like a comedian in a way that you couldn't do as like a leading man. But he also had this like the stickiness of like Borscht Belt comedy. So it's like that came from vaudeville too,
from the Borscht Belt. That's where his parents worked. Yeah, so that direct connection.
Yeah, and that's like a really interesting pairing of like that. Yeah, the sort of like exactitude of the formal camera stuff that he was doing, and then that sort of formal in its own way, the joke structure of you know, vaudeville. Michael, you look
no this is my listening face. I'm like learning more than I'm saying things because I have honestly no relationship with Jerry Lewis at all. As I mentioned, I was introduced to him via Eddie Murphy, another rock star comedian who, you know, people love or hate, but mostly love because he's technically brilliant. And watching this with like, look, this movie specifically, I don't know what it was. I read the synopsis. I was like, what? He hates women? Okay. and he does. Oh, Jerry Lewis doesn't think women are funny. Okay. And then I watched it and I was like, oh God, like you don't see this kind of thing very much anymore. Like such a, like a powerful, electrified, energy. And I don't know, you don't really see great comedies very much anymore. So I was taken aback by how like, oh my God, like, one, yeah, he's so fucking hot. It's obvious, very apparent, like, beautiful guy, but, you know, Hollywood's anti-Semitic, so sorry, you don't get to be a beautiful guy, you know, whatever. But I just found it so fucking, like, laugh out loud funny, and like the Waterboy, Barb and Star go to Vista Del Mar kind of way. I have recommendations, I'll get to it much later, but I was so surprised by how like if something like this were to come out now, it would be perceived as like alternative comedy or something like that. Just loved
I definitely
the strangeness.
Found myself thinking of I Think You Should Leave it yes parts. Like I think Tim Robinson must have been inspired at least in part by like the bursts of rage that Jerry Lewis does and like his physicality when he does them, like there's like to the floor or like, you know,
like
the
some of the jokes
the eyes is one I can't ever get on board with.
We'll never get on that. I think that's probably the thing that turned me off was like, why is he always doing that face? But like, there are certain points that I laughed at like at moments where I probably wouldn't, like where he gets his back stuck in the door and he's like, oh, yes, my back is stuck in, yes. The, yes, my back skin is stuck in the door. I was like, he just said what we saw and I'm dying.
Well, this is one of the, like, the many great, like, dialectics of Jerry, is that, like, that inability to express his characters often, it's not as much in this one as in others, but like he struggles to say words a lot of the time. He's like trying to pronounce things, and then all of a sudden this like perfect lucidity of what's happening is so strange. And so and it's the same with the anger when he's like, he doesn't want anyone to call him Herbie, you know, he's right. Herbert.
Yeah.
Right. Always coming back to that. And it's this strange emotions just like popping out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Well, Esme, you brought up something interesting a minute ago about how, you know, there will be these sort of like when the mask will fall and the sort of like the neuroses and like the sort of like, you know, unfiltered sort of like trauma or whatever, like, you know, psychologically is going on will come out, and it can seem a little, maybe a little cliche, maybe a little like sappy. And there were moments in this movie, even though they are completely different comedic voices, but that reminded me of Richard Pryor's movie, Jojo Dancer, Your Life is Calling.
Oh yeah.
In the way that like these, you know, people who are known for being funny and are, you know, masters at, you know, constructing comedic scenarios and masters at constructing jokes, that will then bare their souls a little bit, and it kind of comes across a little cringy. Like, I mean, do you think that there's something to, like, I don't know, like having like a comedic or being like a someone who is very well versed in being a comedic performer, that like is there maybe an impulse to bare your soul that like inevitably has to seem a little cringy because it's, is it because that it's different from what you typically do, or is it because that like they maybe don't have the nuance to make it seem not cringy? I don't know.
I mean, I think with Jerry, is it's this thing about being the open wound again. You know, he's great at, you know, some of the construction, at some of the comedy, but like as a guy, he's someone who was tried very hard to seem articulate. There's a lot of interviews with him, you know, smoking and being like, oh yes, I was reading Dostoevsky or whatever, you know.
Yes.
Like really like trying to like portray seriousness.
Oh, the full like Woody Allen thing where it's like, I grew up working class in New York, but look, I've read all of Tolstoy. To the listener, we are both pretending to smoke cigarettes right now.
Oh God.
And I think it's just like the things that are out of his, I think what's great about it is the things that are out of his reach, he doesn't treat them like they are. He just fully leans into them. And this is not even the strongest example. There's some like, there's one movie that he only stars in, but kind of, you know, had some involvement in, called The Geisha Boy by Frank Tashlin, who's very kind of formative in his style. And there's this scene where this little Japanese boy comes up to him and looks so sad, like, I've lost my father, you can be my father now. And he turns on the schmaltz, I'll be your daddy now. You know, to such an intense degree, you can't believe, like, someone's actually just going to do that. It's like, that's okay, we're just going to do that. The tasteless, again, it's that mixture. The total lack of, like, taste and, like, sense of what's too much next to in that like incredible set, you know, like one of the most beautiful intricate sets ever made, I think is wonderful, you know. And only someone of his very specific like cultural space could have the power to make a movie so, again, often poorly articulated and poorly thought out on that scale.
Well, I'm going to pose a question to both of you, because I have a theory that I talk about all the time, and I want to know if you guys agree that this is accurate. So I think in like Hollywood comedy, that I think that there were two paths kind of set up by like Chaplin and Keaton, because I think Chaplin is very, very ambitious and very schmaltzy. And I think that Keaton is ambitious in his own way, but he's not looking to, you know, address all of the world's problems. But I think has I don't know, it's maybe more emotionally contained or emotionally precise. And so I think that you can kind of put a lot of like Hollywood comedy people into either camp. Like, for example, I think that like a Woody Allen, he's a chaplain, you know, they're both, right. You know, they both love young children. And they're both schmaltzy.
Right.
And I think that like Albert Brooks is more of a Buster Keaton. Like he's more ironic. He's more detached. But yeah. So I mean, do you think that there's any, because I think that maybe a Jerry Lewis would be more in the kind of like Chaplin camp in that he's, you know, very, very structurally ambitious, but also I think can kind of be underdone by the schmaltz sometimes.
I mean, he believes he's the next Chaplin 100%. He thinks he's making City Lights right now.
Right.
You know? 100%. He's going for that, which is great, you know. No, the Chaplin is very much, I think, for him, a conscious way to, like, because he wanted to be taken seriously. You know, he didn't like that, like, baggage of being, you know, the funny Jewish guy, ultimately. You know, he had a very complicated relationship with his Jewishness.
Right. And I'm sure with Dean Martin and, you know, that, because they, I mean, they both kind of, like, you know, traded on identity in a way. Cause I mean, Dean Martin, like, you know, leaned into the Italianness and, you know, the being a sort of like dissolute drunken guy who loved, had the appetites that, and then like Jerry Lewis had to be the counterpoint to that. But yeah,
this is
interesting.
This is tricky. Cause I'm thinking a lot about my feelings during a lot of comedies. Like watching this made me think of The 40-Year-Old Virgin and like Apatow comedies, and how they will often try to, they'll like, you know, be fucking millions of hours of comedians doing improv, and then you know, they'll edit them together, and there's usually some B story that's trying to be very sincere and like say something, you know, like, and that's why you gotta grow up, and that's why you gotta respect women, and I guess this is the Chaplin school, this fit under the Chaplin umbrella of like, okay, it's interesting to think about, because now I'm trying to, you know, as someone who is very obsessive in how I categorize and organize things in my mind, I'm trying to figure out like who are the auteurs that fit under these, the comedic auteurs that fit under these umbrellas now. Cause I also feel like we have far few of them.
I mean, it's a reductive rubric, but I mean, I definitely think that like an Apatow is like,
but it's true because you said it and you went to school, Shirley.
I didn't go to
school. I trust everything you say.
Chaplin studies, but
you went to school for Chaplin studies and you know,
well, so know. Esme, it sounds like you know like a great deal about Jerry Lewis. So, I mean, when did you first become interested in his work?
Well, it was not so long ago, only a couple of years. Because again, he has no cultural place here, so you have to find him. And I saw Artists and Models because I like Frank Tashlin. Mm-hmm. I like that one. But then this was the second one I saw, the first one he directed, and just like some of the atmosphere is so specific and so strange that became instantly compelled by this, like, you know, half like idiot, this kind of an idiot savant in some ways, and followed him to all the strange, I've watched a million clips of the telecast and he's just a man who never comes to peace with himself, you know. I mean, if you see some of his later movies, Smorgasbord, or I think it might be called Cracking Up in America, it has different names in different places. I mean, that one's fully a comedy movie about wanting to kill yourself, you know. There's like a season where he's gonna hang himself, the thing's not long enough, you know. The same emotional register at certain points of like, you know, we've had a fun time, everyone, but now it's time to get to the true point of what we're doing here, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you would have to be kind of self-loathing, I think, to play his role in The King of Comedy, because I mean, you know, he plays such an obviously based on himself, kind of, and he plays such a rancid kind of character, and like to have a, you know, a role in a movie where like one of the most memorable scenes that you have is a woman on the street yelling at you, "You should only get cancer." Like that's a lot. So, I mean, so I'm not very familiar with his later films other than King of Comedy. So there is a trend in some of his later work that it's kind of like that self, because I think Chaplin again did the same thing with like Mr. Arcaden or no, that one is Wells. But like Limelight and stuff, like, you know, that,
right,
that, you know, Verdi
Chaplin,
or something.
Yeah, that Chaplin also was kind of self-hating, I think, in some of his late films.
And it's similar in the way that the resources get lesser and lesser. Like, right, like some of the late Jerry, because obviously this is such an opulent production, right, and like one of the biggest sets ever built. But by the time we're getting to like Hardly Working, it's just a collection of scenes of like different characters in like grim, low quality film, hardly lit, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they become even less rigorous in some ways. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those ones, Cracking Up is the exception, but most of the ones after the 60s, they get increasingly like bizarre, and like they really are like looking into someone's like private home movies. Oof. You know.
Yeah,
but not in a good way.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah,
this,
yeah,
person's done something, this person's like, you know, like something you'd find, like the guy in Seven would have in his house, you know, the kind of movies he would make.
No, yeah, I mean, I'm you know, I read My Lunches with Orson, the, you know, Henry Jacklum film, mm-hmm, or book, you know, maybe a year or so ago, and it haunts me, because I mean, just Wells at, you know, the end of his days just begging people for money to make another movie, and just, yeah, the idea that like you're so disposable as an artist is like, oof, it is bleak,
but
shit.
It's interesting, right, because the telecasts were so big,
right,
so he had this like one thread where he's super famous still, and you know, mm-hmm, obviously King of Comedy's playing on that, and then the artistic thread becomes more and more marginal, mm-hmm, and more extreme, you know, it really is only for French people at that point, you know, right. I don't think any Americans watching Hardly Working would like go, oh, yeah, this Jerry's back, you know, no one's saying that.
Yeah, and you know, the French thing of like that there's like state funded stuff for the arts, and like, mm, in America there's not. I mean, it's so cutthroat that it's like the minute you're not making money for a studio, you might be a big personality. Yep. Like again, going back to Wells, like, you know, he was making, yeah, commercials and, you know, doing voices in Transformers or whatever and making some money off of that, so it's like he wasn't completely broke, but you know, no one wanted to pay to see what he would do as a true artist. And you know, in America, if you're working in Hollywood, it's like you are subject to the market, and that's it. Like, you know, you're not gonna be like a French filmmaker who's making something at like 100 years old, you know.
Yeah,
yeah. And ultimately, you know, Jerry didn't escape that like label of comedian, you know. Mm-hmm. He's the telephone guy in, right, the end, and I think he resented that an extremely large amount, as you can see from his increasingly bitter interviews as he emphasizes his later years. Yeah, you know.
And honestly, you know, I want to be like that asshole when I think about him being like, women aren't funny. But I think a big part of it is not just that, like, he necessarily hates women. He probably hates women, yeah, a little bit.
He probably hates them a little bit. It's probably not all there is.
We did just watch this movie about him being, yeah, scared. Yeah. It's a nice way of putting it of women.
But there is like a little bit of, you know, there's a little bit of hatred of women, but like also like a little bit of sweetness towards them. And I could see him going in a different, yeah, direction. And I think maybe if his career hadn't kind of tanked like that, because I think that a lot of the resentment came from probably being an older man who can't make the stuff he wants to do, and seeing all these women and people of color and stuff coming in, and like they're getting all these opportunities, and like
they're getting all the jobs.
Yeah, they're not good. Like, and I was good.
It's not like he was particularly pleasant to anyone at that,
exactly,
point. You know? You can, yeah, see some of the interviews where he's just like jabbing at whatever comment they say. He'll, yeah, make sure to turn that against them, you know.
Well, you know, on a lighter note, so like when you were like watching these movies, like when did it first, because I mean, he tends to play like the nerd in the movies. Mm-hmm. But so when did you recognize like, oh, that's like a sexy guy?
Well, I mean, in The Nutty Professor, he has two characters, right?
Right.
And he, like, transforms between them. There's the nerd, and then there's the cool guy.
Oh, yeah.
And yep. I was so taken by, like, how strong his charisma was in that avenue, you know? He can actually really sell the scumbag, but super, you know? I mean, it's a very, like, strange vision of what a cool guy is. Yeah. but still, the charisma is, like, on tap. And so that kind of, like, opened my mind to it. But there's some shots in this movie, you know? I mean, he's his outfits are pretty tight, especially kind of around the back end.
Yeah.
and in each of his movies from this period, there's at least one or two moments where he's like bent over something, or you just get a great ass shot. That's like the first hint. And then the other really important factor for me is, you know, he kind of dresses like a like little boy.
He's
very strange. But then he's wearing the little open...
yes,
like button ups.
Yeah,
and you can just see the massive hair like pouring
he's
through.
So hairy, and it's so hot. Oh my
it's
god,
so good.
Yeah,
a special detail is the watch, the like little silver watch around the big hairy arm. I just fucking love that. That just
girl, you are like making me sweat. Yes, the silver watch and the hairy arms. The hairy arms are huge. We talked before we started recording about how in like the scene with like the gangster. That he like pulls up his shirt and he's got like the hairiest stomach, and my god, and he's got like a solid stomach, and I was like,
and I think it's great that there is some like real ego in that stuff that he knows he's showing it off, you know, he really goes out of his way,
and he definitely there's like an evolution kind of like in his sexiness like throughout the movie, because like he you know makes himself out to be like, you know, the big nerdy Jerry Lewis character in the beginning. He's like, oh, mom and dad, and he's like, you know, crossing his eyes and looking like a dork, but like as the movie goes on, he's in these like tight sweaters, his like shirts are unbuttoned more, like the more time he spends with these women, the more he shows off his body, like, because I mean that's, you know, sort of the plot that these women are more and more, you know, invested in him, like, but yeah, he did not like miss an opportunity to make himself look real good.
Yeah.
But again, those things don't have to be separated with Jerry Lewis. He can be doing the you know stuff but also be a sexy you know, like there's a little animal in him somewhere
there. Yeah. And like I watching him in this movie, I thought a lot about Sid Caesar, because, you know, I haven't watched a ton of like, you know, Sid Caesar's like, you know, performances like in the 50s and stuff, but I have to imagine that like there was some influence because like Caesar was so like prolific, you know, as a, like a TV figure in the 50s, where he could sometimes play the nerd, but also like, and maybe there was more freedom for this on TV, but he played like the Jewish stud like on TV, you know, like he was like a big man and he was famous for like, you know, kind of like roughing up his writers. And yeah, I think that like there was like a kind of interesting evolution in this movie that I think was maybe inspired by some earlier comedians on American TV, maybe, where you see Jerry Lewis's character go from like the nebbish to kind of like a stud.
Yeah, but also, you know, you can't give the arc of the film too much credit for going from one point to another. Yeah. It does jump all over the place, you know.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, it's not so much an arc as like there's one scene at the beginning where he's like, I'm a nerd, and then he's in the house and he's like, actually I'm kinda hot.
Yeah, he doesn't change.
But ultimately, you know, he tries to overcome this, like, you know, you can maybe read it in this way. He tries to overcome this, like, insecurity, this, like, dislike of women. And he kind of almost gets there to a point. And then he goes into the room he's not supposed to go into.
Yes.
Into this, like, spider woman, you know, this symbol of, like, female danger, of consumption. And the set opens up, you know, the wall opens and there's a whole orchestra there all of a sudden. It's such an incredible, inspired, but also like very illogic, very dream logic. Mm-hmm. Like what does it mean that that wall's opening and that there's an orchestra there? Like obviously she's this like predatory female figure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then it has this like joyous, musical, pure white set. It's such a truly so intricate and so strange.
Yeah.
Know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, watching that, I was like, I'm a huge Fellini fan. I was like, my God, yeah. Fellini must have fucking loved this movie. Like, I should have, like, done more research before we got on to see if, like, Fellini has talked about this. But, like, Fellini has to have seen this movie. I mean, Michael, so...
There's a few, like, similar moments. He likes that big orchestra appearing. There's one in, like, Cinderfella, the Tashlin movie he made the year before. There's a poster of it in the background somewhere. So he really did like this, like, big orchestra, you know, big white set thing. It's something he does a few times.
I love that. Yeah, so Michael, like, having watched this as someone who, you know, was not, like, you know, invested in Jerry Lewis, like, before seeing this movie, like... How did those, like, sequences, like, come across to you?
No, I thought it was interesting. I thought this would be, I was like, oh, this is just, honestly, it reminded me a lot of, like, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Like, where it's, on one hand, very dumb, very silly, but the technical expertise required to actually create, you know, this kind of strange world. I don't know. You don't really see, I haven't really seen, like, a lot of those tones get mixed, but every once in a while I'll see something, like, again, in, like, alternative comedy, it'll be like a fucking Tim and Eric or some shit like that, where it's just like, oh, wow, there's, like, a real level of, like, of technical expertise here that I was not prepared for. And then reading, like, oh, he directed the movie. He's, like, such a, like, I guess an auteur comic. It got me to reevaluate him a lot more as a comedic voice and recognize, you know, where there are a lot of artists today that kind of riff on some element of what made him so compelling to the audience.
Yeah, well, so, yeah. I mean, in comparing the movie to, you know, Barb and Star and these other, like, comedic voices, if you... were, you know, tasked to pair this movie with another film or TV show or even skit, like, what would you pair it with? Like, what do you think, if someone loved this movie, what else should they watch?
Okay, I thought about this quite a bit, and so I'm gonna just rattle off a couple of things. If you're going the, you know, goofy man-child route, then, like, something like The Waterboy is probably gonna work for you, or as you mentioned before, there's I Think You Should Leave, which is very apparent from, you know, beat number one of the movie. But the surprising, I guess, kind of pairing that I would do with it is season one of Family Matters, which I don't know how familiar both of you are with
that
the show.
In the UK, Esme?
No, I don't even really know what it is.
Okay, so... It is centered on the Winslow family. They're a normal Chicago family, and they live next door to this guy, Steve Urkel, who's a real genius, but he's a klutz.
I'm aware of him, kind of.
Yeah.
And
also, that's fully like Nutty Professor Jerry.
Right? It's 100% Nutty Farnor Professor.
Hell, yes. And isn't the dad in Die Hard? Yes.
Yeah. Reginald Bell Johnson is in Die Hard. But what kind of made me think of it is the costuming that they use. I didn't recognize, like, watching this, I kind of realized, oh, like, Steve Urkel is a very, like, he's like a black Jerry Lewis reference. I did not know about. I did not recognize that, oh, they're totally 100% doing this character. If you look at his costume, it's exactly the same. And as Jaleel White, the actor, becomes a man over the series, like, he gets fucking shredded, and we're expected to believe that he is a nerd, but, like, he is an athlete in many of the same ways that Jerry Lewis is obviously, like, a Tom Cruise-level physical specimen. The things that he does with his body, the pratfalls that he takes. Watching it and knowing how hard you have to commit to some things, it's just like, oh, God, he's hurting himself, which ultimately is the thing that I think makes a comedian... sexually attractive. Fiend. That is what I have to say.
You have some thoughts, Esme, on that.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I believe there is an episode. This is what I was thinking about. I believe I've seen somewhere there is actually an episode of Family Matters where Steve Urkel has a cool side as well that he transforms into.
Stefan so Urkel. Really like, yeah.
That's really good.
Oh, that's incredible. And it, you know, just to go a little bit deeper on it, so Michael has been taking like clown classes and like reading about clown. So I mean, you talked about like the physical comedy. So I mean, do you have some insight into like what it takes to like do these kind of like pratfalls that they do?
I mean, nothing from a technical perspective in terms of like how to like, you know, like you just have to fall on the ground and get hurt.
There's no way to like protect yourself, so you like don't do it.
There's I think from a just purely audience watching comedy perspective, we all love the big stupid, and that's really it. And we don't see quite as many comedians commit to the big stupid because, you know, they become successful at some point and you know, Marvel gives them an eating disorder and, you know, they send them on their way to, you know, Buff Town. But they don't get to use their instrument quite as much to explore more dimensions of the human experience. And with this, it's very fun to see him play dumb. It's very fun to see him play dumb guy from New Jersey, like complete with his chain, which we have not addressed, but hello, his chain, his little chain. His characters, especially when he's playing dweebs, feel they do feel like they come from a real place, which is why I can't be like, ah, he's just a hot guy pretending to be a nerd. Cause it's like, he knows the aspects of, being a man that are kind of disingenuous and false, and he knows how to play those really well. But in terms of falling, like, yeah.
I also think that kind of leads into the Jewishness, I think, of yes. being an outsider, of being someone trying to kind of... Because a lot of his characters try to be a normal guy, you yeah. know? It's like that line in Clifford, you know, be a normal human.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah. Just act like a normal human boy.
yeah, that's it. There's a lot of that in there, that him trying to like fit into this role and just not being able to, you know, this impotence that I think that character comes from, I think, in his personal life.
Yeah, I think a lot of actors in Hollywood in that era had that. Yeah, that sort of like liminal experience of having conditional whiteness, you know? And they were.
I don't think the average person thought of Jerry Lewis as Jewish because he's quite cagey about it, you know? Sometimes he's very into it, sometimes less so.
Which is so funny because, like, I mean, he, like I was saying earlier, like, he peppers all these like Yiddishisms into the dialogue of like, you want, I should do that though. And even calling himself the Hobbit. Hebert, Hebert.
But it's part of the Hollywood story as such. Yeah, right? And it's same, a lot of Jewish people coming and kind of finding ways to bring that to like a mass audience in a way, but also kind of keeping it, you know, like Jack Warner or someone wouldn't have talked about being Jewish for sure.
Well, my uncle has told me many times about how Samuel Goldwyn, he's like, well, you know, he was Shmuel Geldfish. And so I do think it was like generationally, like Jerry Lewis is at an interesting sort of like middle point. Cause I mean, you look like, you look at someone like Danny Kaye, and he, it wasn't until like late in his life that he started like embracing playing like Jewish roles. Like, I mean, he kind of like erased his identity up until then. And then Jerry Lewis was kind of like in the middle period where like you had some, there were always comedians who, you know, like leaned into their Jewishness, and it was not a big deal because like that's where every comedian came from in Hollywood at the time. You know, from like, you know, the Borscht Belt and, you know, vaudeville, but he kind of like rode the line a little bit, and then you get into like the 70s and then people are like openly Jewish. And it's an interesting sort of like evolution of like, but yeah, he was kind of like in a weird sort of like middle period when he was like at the height of his like, you know, sexual power, I guess.
And as he was in Hollywood, right? Because we're past the 50s, you know, the amount of money Hollywood's making is going down. It's mm-hmm. only going to keep going down from this point, you know, like this is what, 1961, 1962.
Yeah.
So there's only really a few more years before the studio system right. just bottoms out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he was never really there for the peak, you know, only those couple of Tashlin movies in the 50s that were like really there. So, mm-hmm. and then again, he's kind of falls through the cracks because like he's not, not going to fit in with the 70s.
Oh yeah. Because it's only a few years later that like you have like, you know, Dustin Hoffman doing, you know, The Graduate and like Midnight Cowboys. So it's like, you know,
I mean, that's like what, 5 or 6 years after this, which is crazy to think about, you know, how different the like world around it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's no world for like the ladies' man and like the type of performer that Jerry Lewis is anymore, you know? Yeah.
Okay.
Mm. Well, so Esme, like what would you pair with this movie?
Okay. So I'm actually going to not strictly a comedy, but the movie I thought about a lot during this was from another kind of unconscious artist who doesn't necessarily think through their things and lets them pour out. Right. I was thinking of Wild at Heart.
Ooh. Yes!
Great.
Oh my God.
I thought about the scene.
I love this movie.
Where I'm glad you got it. Where Jerry's talking about, this is a very interesting moment actually. He's talking to Katie, you know, the cook again, about his little goldfish mm-hmm. and that he wanted to take his goldfish to bed with him and he woke up and it stopped moving. You know, this is very like weird, but also kind of upsetting, you know, wanting to be close to something and then like destroying it, you know, which kind of, or vice versa in the case of his girlfriend who dumps him, who's called like Faith or something.
Right.
Like, lost Faith, you know, literally. get it? Yeah. But then Kathleen Freeman like starts breaking down into tears and crying mm-hmm. and that like the fact that the emotionalness is coming out of everyone really reminded me of, I can't remember who plays her, but the mom in Wild at Heart, you know, when she's painting her whole face with lipstick.
Diane
it's
Ladd.
Just that like Diane Ladd, the emotion like bursting out, it's just on the seams, and both of these are like, I think David Lynch is more conscious than he lets on, but
for
like
sure.
he very much lets ideas come out of him in the same way Jerry does, in a less kind of harmonious way.
Right.
But that's okay, you know, whatever. As long as it's coming from somewhere, it's coming from somewhere, you know.
Well, they're both so interesting because I feel like they're both letting out these enormous feelings in a messy way through a very controlled. Mm-hmm. framework, and I think that
the
Jerry 100%. Lewis framework is very like a formal framework, and not that like, you know, that Lynch doesn't have like a formal framework to his work, he does obviously, but I think that Lynch maybe has more of a framework of like characters and their relationships mm-hmm. to each other, and then lets that, you know, wild feeling come out, you know.
So much with David Lynch that I like really appreciate is that film is his second medium and his first is painting. And so mm-hmm. like his approach to painting is fucking wild because, I mean, I'm not a painter myself. I paint, but how he's so interested in playing with different textures and things that are just elements mm-hmm. that are beyond color. He found his way to film by just thinking, you know, like, oh, I want to make I want to make a painting that moves. And that's how he found his way to film. And he kind of uses actors and physical types and sets to as the same way that a painter uses color. They're just these forces that he can't totally control. But I don't know. I love David Lynch and I love Wild at Heart. It is such a deeply funny and deeply horny film. I watch it at least twice a year.
Just thinking formally about the movie, I think my pairings would be Fassbender's Carell and Fellini's And the Ship Sails On, because I think that all three movies are so fascinating in the way that they use these constructed sets that are very obviously artificial, but the artificiality lends itself to the fascination of like the movies. And I love a fake set. I love something where you can tell that it was shot like in a studio. I think that's great. So like
Wizard of Oz, all day long, love that.
Oh yeah. I'm all about like late period Fellini. Like I love when you can tell like that the water was like made by tarps or whatever. But yeah, I my favorite part of The Ladies' Man was the set and like how beautifully it was used. And yeah, so I think that Carell and The Ship Sails On both use their sets so gorgeously, and they give you like a real sense of space. And I think the mise-en-scène and like, yeah, the way that like they employ the camera throughout these sets, like you feel like you're in a real lived-in space in a way that is very exciting to me.
Yeah, when
I think it's an interesting contrast of like old Hollywood sets is that they are obviously fake, right? Like they have very like designed, but that also makes them more real because it draws your mind to the fact this is literally something. Like it's not something totally, it's not like Avatar, you know, which is like CGI pure abstraction. This is actually a space that the characters are in. So like, you know, a really obvious example would be Singing in the Rain when, you know, opens up in the sky, right? There's this big painted sky. And it's both more real and more fake at the same time. I think it's a really interesting thing that they employed then, and just no one has the money or interest to do anymore, or that's, doesn't want to pay the unions of set decorators. Right.
That's what I thought about, like when The Ladies' Man, when they like pan away and you first see how like enormous the set is, I was like, damn, that was a lot of people's jobs, like a lot of people who worked on that set. Never again. You know.
Yeah.
And honestly,
not for a comedy, for sure. Oh,
not for a comedy. We don't give money to comedies at all.
And it probably wouldn't be like a huge price difference to build a set like on these existing Hollywood lots versus like doing everything in CGI and like having your actors just like be in like a big warehouse with like blue screens in Atlanta. Like it probably wouldn't be that different, but it's very depressing that the studios want to keep open the option that they might not ever have to have human workers again. So why build something physical?
It's a lack of personal vision too, right? Yeah. Like with those big movies is the fact that it's like they can always tweak it later. If it doesn't work, we'll figure it out later. With a big set, you're stuck with it. You know, someone's built this and that's it. You can't afford to like tear it down or change it. That's it, you know.
I mean, the depressing thing, like watching the strikes going on right now, is that like, you know, Barbie just like became one of like the highest grossing movies of all time. And in part, it's because audiences loved coming to see actors in a physical environment that was well designed and cool looking. Like that's why people like it. It's not just writing. It's not just the directing. It's that like the production design was really cool. So you want to go sit in a theater and watch it.
We've been starved of this for years, which is why anytime we watch like even a mediocre movie from the previous decades, if it has an amazing set and there's real stuff and there's real makeup and there's like very little CGI unless there needs to be, I'm like, Shelley, why? We just watched the best movie ever. And it's like, it's not that. It's not that. It's just, you're just starved.
It's a competently made movie that was shot on film. Oh my God. Crazy. Yeah. Well, on that bummer of a note, we do
I still have hope. Still have hope. We'll figure it out.
The most down episode of the podcast so far.
But we are going to finish out with a quiz. So one thing that we've touched on and that I thought about a lot as I was watching The Ladies' Man is Jerry Lewis made a movie about a guy who kind of hates women, kind of is scared of women, but is also obsessed with women. And that's kind of like a common trope in movies, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
There's nothing else can be said.
It's a common trope in men, I think.
Ooh, was that a thing?
It's a common trope in men.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh.
Fascinated with women. Don't understand women. Angry at women.
Yeah. And yet. So we are going to do a little quiz where I am going to give you a description of a movie that similarly is by a male director who is obsessed with women, is scared of women, but is also, you know, he needs them. He hates them. He needs them. He hates them. So I'm going to give you four questions about that. And then our last question is going to be the opposite of that. So that is a very convoluted way to say.
No, I'm picking it up. I'm you're putting it down. I'm like, yep, I get it.
Yeah, I was like, this is like a very kind of like, you know, hard to define like type of.
But the
quiz.
The ideas are coming out of you. And that's what really matters.
Yeah. Basically, male filmmakers. They love women. They hate women. They're obsessed with them. They feel that they are constantly stalked by them. And they made a lot of movies about it. So, question number one. Asanissimasa. This 1963 film is the urtext of men haunted by women in cinema italiano. Asanissimasa.
Eight and a half?
Yes, it's 8.5.
Yeah.
8.5 by Federico Fellini. Yeah. It's about
for
a
the
guy
listener, who... I also knew that, and I just want to acknowledge, thank you, Shelley, for putting some questions in here that I'd be able to get.
Oh, listen, I am doing my best to make sure that we've all got things we can answer.
Thank God.
All right, this one we're going to be naming the star. Okay, so in the 1925 film, to go back really quickly, we have talked about almost all of these filmmakers in our conversation so far, so we couldn't help it. So keep that in mind.
Okay.
In the 1925 film, Seven Chances, a silent comedian famous for risking bodily harm and being a hunky little guy is chased down the street by an enormous swarm of women seeking his inherited fortune. What is the name of this film star?
Oh, God.
Silent comedy, hunky little guy.
Hunky little guy.
I feel like I want to give Michael a chance because I do know.
Look, dude, I'm going to get it.
Cosme, come on.
Buster Keaton.
It's Buster Keaton, yeah. Yes.
Here's the thing. I was thinking, like, who does Shelley love? And I thought of a completely different little guy that we didn't talk about at all. I started thinking about, like, Harold Lloyd. And I was like, oh, God, why am I thinking about Harold Lloyd?
Just one thing on Seven Chances. Jean Arthur is in that movie very briefly. As one of the seven women who he asked to marry.
Oh my God, I completely forgot about that.
She's the receptionist.
Oh my God. If you haven't seen Seven Chances, guys, watch this movie. It is so good. We love Keaton and we love Jean Arthur. All right.
Question for you, yes. Shelley.
Okay.
Do you love Harold Lloyd?
Of course I do.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to make sure because that's what I was thinking about. I was like, it's got... Okay. He also lost some fingers, so that's why I was thinking, like...
Yeah, no, that's pretty
cool. Yeah. Oh, my God. Are you kidding me? Yeah. And also, I will say that I am sorry that in my binary of Chaplin versus Keaton that I left out Harold Lloyd. He's a man of his own, you know?
So there's three categories.
Unfortunately, I don't think
he's
set
middle way.
Up.
He's a third way.
Yeah, there we go. Yes. Yeah, if you got a Venn diagram, then Harold Lloyd is in the middle. All right, number three. This one is going to harken back to another question. Una donna senza uomo. City of Women is a spiritual and thematic and maybe literal sequel to this 1963 Fellini film.
Ah, ding ding.
Yes, Michael.
8.5.
Yes,
it is. I love when the answers are the same as previous answers.
The next one's going to be Buster Keaton as well.
Yeah.
Yes. Ooh, yes.
You should be so lucky. Come on. But I couldn't do 8.5 and not do City of Women because those are the two movies that for me are the most about a guy being like, God, I'm so horny, but ugh, these women are so scary.
God. I got to watch 8.5, it sounds like.
You gotta watch 8 and a half and then watch Chite de la Donna, because it is great. Okay, number four. This movie has the horniest and most stylish open heart surgery choreographed by Bob Fosse in cinema history.
Ooh.
All that jazz?
Yes.
I gotta see all that jazz.
Michael! Okay, we're gonna have to do a whole episode about like movies about guys who are stressed out about how horny they are.
Yeah, I can't do that. I was raised Catholic. Like, this has been, that was my life for such a long time. Like, I don't know if I can re-experience it.
Love Fellini, because that's his whole deal. He's too Catholic and he's too horny.
Oh God.
Okay, so number five. This one we're going the opposite. So this is a movie directed by a man, but there are no men in it. And well, there are men in it, but only as objects of complete disdain. So in this movie, four women are in a red house and they basically never think about men except for when one puts a shard of glass in her vagina so she doesn't have to sleep with her husband.
I did not see this.
It's from,
no, I don't think I saw this.
It's from the 70s. It's a famous Swedish director.
Shard of Glass? Mm-hmm. What?
It's from, I think, 1973, I believe. It's got Liv Ullmann. Red House.
Okay, I'm going on red. Oh, God, what's it called? Something and something.
Yeah, yeah.
Cries and Whispers.
Cries and Whispers. Yes. Oh my God, Esme, you nailed it.
Oh my God,
Michael, you got.
I just knew there was a shot with red in it. To be honest, that's all I had to go on.
Esme, you killed it, and you also killed it in our conversation. Thank you so much for being on. This was, oh my God, such a blast.
Thank you for opening my mind to Jerry Lewis. This needed to happen.
You're welcome, Andy, and I apologize.
Well, Esme, is there anywhere people can follow you on social media? And do you have anything cool coming up that people should look out for?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter or X, I guess that was called, at Esme Says with two S's on the end. I couldn't get it normal, but I needed the Velvet Underground thing, so I had to do that.
Of course.
Coming up, I know you had Hannah Strong on a while ago, so she should thank me for this. I have a piece coming up on Little White Lies, but it's behind their membership paywall, so you have to pay to read it.
Right.
It covers some of the things we talked about, and it's about superfluous scenes in movies.
Ooh.
Oh my God. Oh.
Can you give us like just a little taste of like one superfluous scene?
So, well, it's got a pretty wide swath of references. We go from Hong Kong martial arts movies. We've got the Marx Brothers. The basis of it is starting with the Marx Brothers scenes where Chico plays the piano and Harpo plays the harp.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like Zeppo for some reason is like in a boat, like, you know, like talking to a lady, like there's a swan going by. Amazing. Oh, that rules. Oh my God. Ah, I cannot wait to read this. I am going to, be tweeting about this article. I cannot wait. Michael, where can people follow us?
You can follow us on all social media platforms, including X, at Everyone Is Hot Pod. That's every number one is Hot Pod. And wherever you are listening to this podcast, please rate us 5 stars. Anything less, we'll get you canned.
Yeah, don't do it. Don't do it. Why? But why should you do this?
For why should you do this?
Oh, why? Come on.
Oh, gosh. And Shelley, what should the listeners do?
Hey, lady, stay horny.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.